next presenter is Kara Fetira. Hope I got your name right.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Kara Fertitta Roberts. I'm from the University of California, Riverside, and I'm going to talk with you today about some work I've been doing on assessing sustainability trade-offs in sorghum bioenergy production. So before I get into really the meat of the talk, I first just want to quickly overview some terminology that's central to this work. The first term is productivity sustainability trade-offs. And when I say this, essentially, I'm referring to any management practice that may serve to increase yield at the expense of an adverse environmental outcome. So, for instance, very intensified use of agrochemicals often represents a productivity sustainability trade-off. The second term I want to go over is intersustainability trade-offs, and this really refers to choices which reduce the severity of one environmental impact, but perhaps displace that environmental burden elsewhere. Okay, so getting into the project objectives, we had three objectives for this project. The first thing we wanted to look at was productivity sustainability trade-offs occurring just in feedstock production, which sounds like most people here are oriented with. For anyone who does LCAs, this is a well-to-farm gate scope we were looking at. So we were interested to see what these productivity sustainability trade-offs were across different management scenarios and whether there's kind of a sweet spot where you can get that high productivity without perhaps the accompanying adverse environmental outcomes. Next, we wanted to see if we expanded the scope to look at the entire wheel-to-well life cycle of our fuel product, which for us was E85 from sorghum-derived cellulosic ethanol. Do we still see the relevance of these productivity sustainability trade-offs? Do they ultimately impact the sustainability of this fuel product, or do they get kind of washed out by all of the other processes in the life cycle? Lastly, we wanted to see if we take our whole wheel-to-well life cycle of our E85 fuel product and compare that to conventional gasoline. Conventionally, we're always expecting and hoping to see reduced greenhouse gas emissions, but if we evaluate that across multiple dimensions of sustainability, are we still seeing, all benefits, or are there perhaps some trade-offs that are occurring when we substitute gasoline for these ethanol-based fuels? Okay, so to quickly overview the methods, anyone who does modeling will know that this is a vast oversimplification, but bear with me, it's a 15-minute talk. So we started with a field trial. We grew forage sorghum in the Imperial Valley for 3 years. The Imperial Valley has a very mild winter, and this allowed us to get 2 to 3 harvests per year and really, really high yields in this site. We then took our field trial data and used that to build a feedstock production model in DSAT. And once that model was calibrated, we implemented 97 different management scenarios in the model to look at yield output and nutrient and water uptake. From there, we selected a subset of scenarios that we wanted to investigate further with life cycle assessment. We coupled these with downstream emission models for fertilizer and fuel components of the life cycle. And we use this data to build our life cycle inventory models in SEMAPRO. We then characterize these life cycle inventories with TRACE, which is the EPA's characterization method, and it spans 9 different environmental impact categories, spanning from environmental to human health. This gave us our E85 life cycle assessments, and then we additionally constructed a life cycle assessment for conventional gasoline. Within our crop model, we varied several factors in our management scenarios. We first looked at irrigation intensity, which I'm largely going to ignore today because it was less interesting. We also looked at nitrogen intensity, varying fertilizer from no fertilizer applied all the way to a very liberal 385 kilograms per hectare. We additionally looked at fertilizer strategy, and that had 2 components, the type of fertilizer applied and then the application method for those different fertilizers. So once we looked at the output of all of this, we selected the scenarios that we thought would be most interesting to proceed with life cycle assessment, and of course, our attention was immediately drawn to the extremes of our data output. So across the board, urea broadcast not incorporated was our worst scenario. It always resulted in the lowest yields. So that was an obvious candidate we wanted to look at. And I'll refer to that from here on out as urea BNI. Conversely, our highest yields were seen when we injected urea at 8 centimeters depth, which I'll refer to as urea ionate. And no, we didn't really expect for both of our best and worst scenarios to come from more than one fertilizer type. So we were interested in looking at an additional treatment. And we did have a few treatments that were fairly competitive in yield with urea ionate. So the one that we selected was UAN applied through the irrigation, and we chose this not only because it's a different mechanism of kind of incorporating the fertilizer into the deeper layers of the soil, but also because it has a reduced fuel intensity. You don't have to run another machine. You just inject it into the, add it into the irrigation water. Because I won't really talk about this further in the talk, I'll mention now that fuel component was not important at all in determining the environmental impacts. Okay. Oh, sorry. I will refer to that as UAN-IRI. So to go into the crop model output, this is showing you basically the nitrogen use efficiency across different fertilizer intensities. Right now, it's just showing for urea ionate, our highest yielding treatment. If we add in the data points for UAN-IRI, we see something quite similar. And this is really a pretty characteristic response curve to nitrogen intensity. We get a positive response that then begins to saturate at our high nitrogen levels. However, if we look at our poor performing treatment, urea BNI, we see a very different story. We had highly inefficient nitrogen uptake in this treatment, less than half often of what we saw in our other treatments, and this, of course, corresponded to much lower yield and much higher volatilization losses. And you can see the red dots are the highest fertilizer level, the highest yields we got with urea BNI, and they're quite similar to the lowest yields we got with our other treatments. So there was a massive difference, really, between these three. Okay, so how did this then impact the environmental impacts at the well-to-farm gate scope? This is a very overwhelming figure, and I don't want you to try and take it all in right now. I promise to break it up and go through it bit by bit. What I first want to draw your attention to is just what we're looking at here. Each of the 9 panels is an environmental impact category that we investigated. They are all on the basis of 1 megagram of dry weight, so everything you're seeing is yield scaled already. In terms of the color spread here, we have the gradient of fertilizer intensity that we applied, and that's broken up into each fertilizer strategy we investigated. And then the white portions of the bars are representing emissions coming from all other sources, so fuel, seeds, pesticides, etc. We start with our F0 as our no fertilizer treatment for comparison. Okay, so now I'm going to go through this piece by piece so we can actually understand what's going on here. There were a few environmental impact categories that had an increased response in emissions to increased nitrogen intensity regardless of fertilizer strategy. Notably, global warming is one. That's something we care about a lot. It is also noticeable that you see much higher increases with increasing N intensity in our urea BNI scenarios, which, you know, is logical following the really weak yield response we saw there. In addition to seeing this kind of more substantial adverse response in urea BNI treatments, we also saw this response much more frequently in urea BNI treatments than in our incorporated strategies. One kind of interesting thing we didn't really expect to see was this decline in non-carcinogenic emissions with increasing fertilizer intensity. This is the only category that we saw this in, and it was really because the increase was quite small relative to the yield response, regardless of treatment. What we saw a little more frequently, particularly in our incorporated treatments, was an initial decline in emissions from no fertilizer to about low to moderate amounts. And then when we increased beyond a moderate fertilizer rate, we started to see kind of a leveling off or a slight increase in emissions. Or more frequently, what we saw is after that initial decline, we would then get an increase in emissions at the higher nitrogen fertilization rates. So the takeaway from this is essentially that productivity sustainability trade-offs were largely unfavorable for urea BNI. We got very weak yield responses and very high emissions responses. However, they were generally favorable for our incorporated scenarios, at least at the low to moderate fertilizer rates. Those resulted in increased yields, and in some cases reduced emissions. However, there were some inter-sustainability trade-offs here because we did see some categories increase. However, if we do not weight the value of these different categories, we saw greater declines across categories than increases. And these trade-offs become less favorable as we increase N intensity. So at high N rates, you're still getting, you know, some positive responses, but you're getting a lot more increase in emissions. So to see how this then translates to the well-to-wheel level, I'm just going to show you the percentage of well-to-wheel emissions, so all the way from production of the feedstock to combustion of the fuel, what percentage of those emissions are coming from feedstock production. And I'm showing this for our highest emitting scenario as well as our lowest emitting scenario. So we see very significant contributions to eutrophication, which is, you know, quite logical, coming from agriculture. These emissions didn't vary very much across treatments because they're largely tied to phosphorus inputs, which were constant across all treatments. We do also see large contributions to acidification, and these were much more variable because they're more tied to nitrogen inputs. Similarly, we see great variability in the contributions to smog emissions because of its affiliation with nitrogen. But really, across nearly all of our environmental impact categories, we're seeing a pretty substantial contribution of feedstock production to the overall emissions from the life cycle of this fuel product. In many cases, they're upwards of 30%, sometimes as high as 78%. So really big contributions to the overall sustainability of this fuel product. And in these categories, you are getting those translated impacts, those productivity sustainability trade-offs that we saw at the well-to-farm gate level. In a couple of categories, ozone depletion, ecotoxicity, and smog in our low-emitting treatment, we don't really see very substantial contributions. Okay, so now getting to our comparison of E85 and gasoline. I'm going to start with global warming because that's what most people immediately pull their attention to. We do see a really positive response here. So this, on the y-axis, what you're seeing is the difference between emissions from E85 and gasoline divided by the emissions from gasoline, right? So we see about a 50 to 70% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions with our E85, and that's a great response. We additionally see declines in carcinogenic emissions, non-carcinogenic emissions, and ecotoxicity, which is still a little puzzling to me, but I'm working on it. So this is all good. However, as you may notice, there's a lot of blank spots here, so this is not the end of the story. We saw increases in emissions to acidification, to respiratory effects, and quite substantially to eutrophication and ozone depletion, as well as increases to emissions to smog. So it's pretty evident here that we have a lot of inter-sustainability trade-offs occurring. And it also should be evident that we don't necessarily want to consider all of these categories equally, as, you know, they all have the same weight as environmental burdens. However, I think the results really do beg the question of how do we balance our desire to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions in alternative energy with, you know, these potential other environmental impacts that come along with it, like water pollution, air pollution, something I didn't even mention today, deforestation, but we all know is a consequence of increasing bioenergy. So I think continuing in bioenergy, it's really important that we focus on how we consider these other elements of sustainability and how we weight their importance so that we don't risk displacing this environmental burden we're experiencing with greenhouse gas emissions to other sectors of the environment. And with that, I will take any questions. Most of our conversion data came from Spitari and McLean 2010. We used a high efficiency conversion scenario. We also modeled a low efficiency scenario, but the emissions were actually higher in the high efficiency scenario because we displaced the electricity co-product. So that was much more substantial in a low efficiency scenario. So we thought the high efficiency scenario would actually represent a more conservative estimate of emissions.